Joining me in the studio for the July edition of Our Town is Congresswoman Val Hoyle. And it's good to see you again. I hope things have been going well.
Thank you very much for having me here today. And it's really good to be here. And I think things are going well. I mean, this is my first term, and I was very lucky in that Peter DeFazio, who was my predecessor, has been really, really helpful in helping me onboard. And the vast majority of his staff stayed. So my entire state staff, my caseworkers, my state director, who's our deputy chief of staff, all stayed. So people who have come to rely on our office to help navigate with federal agencies and federal issues are going to be dealing with the same people. So I had kind of a turnkey office with people that understood the job, but then they went from working with a chairman who had 36 years of experience in Congress and just an incredible background and knowledge in policy to a freshman in the minority with a very different background and style. So it's been fun for all of us. But again, I feel like I've done well because the issues I focus on have been bipartisan. And we've been able to actually be pretty successful in 6 months.
I was kind of interesting when you were talking about that, because what came to my mind humorously was the movie Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy, where he gets there as the freshman, and all of a sudden he's learning all these things that he was supposed to do before he got there and realizes he's way behind the eight ball, right? You know, because he didn't. And you luckily had that support system in place.
Yeah, having that support system and that office, and then my chief of staff, who had worked on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee with Congressman DeFazio, and then worked on transportation policy with Governor Kitzhaber, Governor Brown, and then ran Oregon Solutions. She knows D.C. and knows the 4th Congressional District as well. So having someone of that caliber come in, it allowed me to be able to focus on building relationships, because I had some of the basics covered in a way other freshmen didn't, because they had to hire completely new offices. And again, having my predecessor, who is there to be helpful, because I'm also on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and the Natural Resources Committee. And those are the two committees that Peter served on, and they are critical to this district. So I feel very lucky. I got a pretty good hand up.
Well, I know there's a few of the issues you want to get into, and I certainly want to talk about those, and we'll have time for that. But I also want to ask you, you know, when you first stepped into D.C., what were your first thoughts from a congresswoman's standpoint when you got there? What first went through your mind when you started getting situated?
So I didn't know what to expect. I thought I would be walking into a place that nobody worked in a bipartisan way, that was very dysfunctional, because that's what we hear on the news. My first experience in Congress was the 4.5 days it took to elect a speaker. We voted 15 times on a speaker, and so that has not happened since, I think, the 1800s.
So that kind of came across as a little dysfunctional to you?
It was dysfunctional. It was weird. But it was an opportunity, because we all were on the floor of the House. And normally you get to talk to the people on your committee, and then you sit on the side with Democrats, Republicans sit on another side. And sometimes, you know, you can talk to people in those areas, but there's 435 people. So you don't get to visit with people and actually get to know them as humans. And during those 4.5 days, a number of us made it a point to go and sit down and talk to other people, both Democrats and Republicans, and start visiting and finding out about them. Look, there's some people that aren't interested in making government work. They want to break it. Those are not the kind of people that I'm going to try and have a relationship with, because They're problem solvers,
and
right?
There's nothing you can say to them.
Not a thing I can say to them. But there's a whole lot of other people, and this has been the most surprising thing, is that there's a whole lot of people, the vast majority of them, who came to Congress for a reason, and they may have different backgrounds and experience than me. They may have different politics or policy ideas, but they really want to get things done and represent their district. And so I've been able to work in a bipartisan way and build relationships with both Democrats and Republicans, people from urban and more rural areas than me, really well. And that's what surprised me, is that things are happening and there is an ability to do things in a bipartisan way if you just focus on what you agree on. And for me, again, I'm in one of the less than 40 districts in the country where you can't get elected by one party or another. In Oregon, we have 6 congressional districts. We just added one last election cycle. And 3 of the 6 are swing districts, so can't be elected with just one party or the other. And I think that makes me a better legislator, because I can't just listen to one side. And I truly think the country would be better if we had more swing districts. We used to. But now we have districts where the vast majority, again, less than 40, are swing, where you win in the primary. So people that get elected play to the most partisan base, right? So they don't have to reach across the aisle. And in fact, sometimes when they do, they end up not getting reelected. We saw this with Jamie Herrera Butler, who represented a swing district and operated and governed in that way, and she lost her election. Or Adam Kinzinger, or, you know, you can name so many people that were moderate and then were voted out. Kurt Schrader on the other side, right? He is in a swing district. So I think that I like representing a swing district. I did in the House. I worked in a bipartisan way as labor commissioner. But fundamentally, I'm a Democrat. I ran as a Democrat. And I think as long as you govern by values and you're straightforward and honest to where you come from, I'm always going to stand up for labor and working people. I come from a strong union background. I was a third-generation union member. So I have this opportunity because my father and grandfather were able to bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions, and that's part of my values. I'm pro-choice. I think that the decision on whether to have an abortion should be between a woman and their doctor. I believe that there should be a strong safety net for people who need it. Those are my values. Those are matters of substance. But on many other things, I can work with people across the political spectrum. And my focus in Congress has been 2 things. One is to work on the Port of Coos Bay. We're working on getting a $500 million mega grant that will help us deepen the channel and build a larger container port. It's a public-private partnership. And that would bring 8,000 jobs, 2,400 just in building the port. That would be transformational to the South Coast to bring back economic prosperity and opportunity. And the second is wildfire funding and preparation. We have to do things differently. These fires are different. And for a variety of reasons, we are now in a place that we have to change our approach. So not the least of which is putting more money up front for prevention, as opposed to having the government just write a blank check when the fires get out of control. It's backwards. It doesn't make sense. We're having accountants determine how we fight fires, and that's wrong. So those 2 things are very bipartisan, and we have the support of the entire Oregon delegation, and again, Republicans and Democrats across the country.
What's interesting is that, like in medical, they are now coming around to finding out that prevention is the way to cure the costs later in life when there's so much sickness and ill health. Same thing with wildfire. Prevention is more of the way to do that. Going back to the Coos Bay story, where are you at for this mega fund here? How close?
So there was a first application for the grant, and the Port of Coos Bay did not receive that grant. We then worked with the Department of Transportation on getting technical service and finding out where we needed to strengthen the application. And part of that was making sure that we showed state support. The entire coastal legislative delegation led by David Gomberg, who carried the bill, worked on making sure that we could have permission to do the dredging of the channel, and also got us $40 million towards the dredging of the channel. And by the state putting up that $40 million, it puts us in a significantly better position to receive the $500 million in this second round grant application. So the Port of Coos Bay is putting in the grant application, and we should hear in a few months, but it would be transformational.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, I hope that happens. Well, it also is not just economically important, but for the country, it would reduce the supply chain congestion on the West Coast by 10%. Right now in Canada and Prince Rupert Sound, they've just invested $2 billion in their port on the West Coast, and 70% of those containers are coming to the U.S. So there is a need for this. We can be that solution for the nation, and we can move these containers directly to rail. We'll have rail upgrades as well, taking diesel trucks off the road. So it's a win-win situation that provides economic opportunity, and it is my number one priority, and I'm very excited about it.
Another one of the things you mentioned you'd like to talk about is rural health care. Now, luckily here in Florence, we have a wonderful hospital here to work with, and a lot of good doctors there. But not every community is like that. When you go down to Reedsport or go down to some of the other hospitals, I know that the Coos Bay's had some trouble over the years. What needs to happen? What is your goal? What are you going to be working on to strengthen rural health care?
So I think part of it is how we fund our healthcare systems. We fund, first of all, Medicare and Medicaid. They do not reimburse at a level that actually that reimburses for actual cost, and that disproportionately affects people who are seniors or vulnerable. My district has the third highest amount of Social Security recipients in the country. So it's a large senior population. We have the largest veterans population. And we have a number of issues. So the first is reimbursement. And the second is what Governor Kitzhaber used to focus on, which is we should be paying for outcomes as opposed to paying for procedures. And I'd like to see that transformation happen. And then in rural areas, two of the biggest issues are finding workforce and housing. So in the Bay Area Hospital, they were working to recruit a doctor, and that doctor could not find a house to buy or rent. On the coast, there's barely, you know, half a percentage of vacancy rates, and that affects workforce. We were at the Job Corps for the Forest Service yesterday. They have trouble finding housing. The Coast Guard has trouble finding housing. Pacific Seafood is building housing. But when we look at our medical practitioners, everything from medical assistants straight up to doctors, we need practitioners that can be, you know, in the communities, which means recruiting people from those communities. So I think healthcare apprenticeship programs, which we have worked as labor commissioner, I worked on, and, you know, the Bureau of Labor and Industries is expanding those opportunities so you can get paid while you learn. I think housing, making sure we have housing for workforce and first responders. I've sponsored some bills for that. And then finally, recognizing that we have to change how we're delivering healthcare, which means allowing reimbursements for telehealth, for instance, making sure that we're investing in broadband. And we just got $2.5 million to go towards the Curry County chemotherapy treatment project that comes out of the hospital down there. People were having to drive to Eugene for chemotherapy, and that's like could be 3-4 hours each way in the winter. It's a brutal drive, and for anybody that knows someone or has had to go through chemotherapy, that is brutal and awful. So again, getting care where we are, but really getting the care that people need upfront, that primary care, the palliative care. I know that they just closed palliative care here in the hospital in Florence, but they're shifting to in-home care. I think keeping people in-home as much as possible, changing what we reimburse for. So we're reimbursing for health outcomes to treat patients like people as opposed to just procedures.
Housing, obviously, it's a big deal here as well, and some of the same things that you were talking about go here. I mean, even when a doctor who can afford a more costly home still can't necessarily find something that is suitable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the solution is up to Congress to fix that. I mean, there's, you know, it's up to communities as well to find the heart to make it a priority.
So we're in a situation where we don't have enough housing. And we talk a lot about low-income housing, which is really important. But every employer I talk to on the coast, Roseburg has 0.5% vacancy rate, so people have issues there. Eugene, Corvallis, everywhere. John Day, same thing. We need more housing stock. So it's not just low-income housing. We need medium-income housing. We need high-income housing. I did sponsor the a program to help first responders and educators buy their first home built off of the Veterans Home Loan Program. We want people who are workers and workforce to be able to afford to live in the communities that they work in. But, you know, you have to have the housing stock. So it is not a federal, I don't think the federal government is a solution to everything. This really is the state. And I know this is a priority for the governor, and she understands that we have to have more housing stock, and local communities. The solution in Florence is different than the solution in Portland, which is different than the solution, you know, in Coos Bay, right? Or and so we have to work with local communities, but fundamentally, we're in a place where people have to change the approach. So people don't want to build up because it blocks their view. They don't want to build out because it's sprawl. And we don't want to build over farmland that you can't get back. But we have to change what we're doing. It is not working. And that means each local community, and I will do whatever I can to support local communities. Mayor Jessica Engelke in North Bend has applied for a federal grant because they're working at building some workforce housing. So the city, in partnership with other with businesses, working to build housing so that people who work in North Bend can afford to live in North Bend. And those kind of projects we can help with directed funding, but it is a local community that needs to make the choice. And it has to change.
Well, and the problem is, too, in many communities like this one here, we are so far behind that even if we were able to build 200 units this year, we're still 1,500 to 2,000 units behind.
Right.
So it's going to be a longer process. And like we were talking before we went on the air, you know, there's the idea that a retail employee just can't make it.
Right.
Just can't make it with the cost of living. Because of housing.
We were talking to the Forest Service and the Job Corps people, and they, because the federal government thinks that Oregon is a less expensive place to live than New York, right? They have one of the lowest sort of pay reimbursement rates because it goes by where you live. So one of the things we're going to try and do is make sure that pay gets increased to actually reflect how much housing costs. And yes, this is an extreme crisis, and I am grateful for Tina Kotek's focus on this.
One of the House bills that just recently did not pass because at the end they added an amendment that said rural communities could expand their urban growth boundaries, was killed because of that. Now, here in Florence, I've talked to our mayor and our city manager. We do have enough room within our current boundaries to provide enough housing for it, but some communities don't have that. I don't know, are you familiar with that? And does that seem like something that could cause a problem, not being able to? Because everyone says you don't want sprawl. You mentioned that yourself. Nobody wants sprawl. But at some point, you know, unless we stop the population increase, you know, what are we going to do?
So I am familiar with that bill, and it did move through the House, and there were portions of it that were controversial. It might have been easier had there been more senators to vote on the bill, but there were a number of people that
That's
didn't
another story
show
altogether.
Up, and that is not what we're here to talk about. I know that the governor will go back to the drawing board and will bring something up in February. We can't keep doing the same thing. So we have to figure out where people can build, how we can protect our farmland. We protect our old growth forests, make sure that where we're building is not going to be in the middle of a wildfire. But we can't just keep doing the same thing. And I applaud the governor for really leaning in on finding some kind of a solution. And yes, this didn't pass this time, but something will in February, because we can't just keep saying no. We can't just keep saying no, because the services that people want need to have people that provide them. And that means you have to have workforce. And we have people who, again, I have the third highest number of Social Security recipients in the country. And these people need to afford to live and live with dignity, which means that housing needs to be affordable. If we want young people to be able to succeed, they have to be able to afford to buy a home. Those were the opportunities that were afforded us and the generation previous to us. Our children deserve that. So we have to do it differently. And I have faith in the governor and the legislator. Certainly the legislators here on the coast, both Democrats and Republicans, understand the issue. And I know they're committed to working to bring some solutions forward.
Because of some of the crisis now, I mean, I'm 62 now, when I was a teenager, you know, most kids my age wanted to be out of the house before we were 20. Now it's 25 to 28 years old when kids are having to stay home or having at least some sort of support, you know, from their parents in order to get by. So that's a tough thing. One of the other things that you mentioned, and it's something that when I first moved to Oregon, I thought I was coming to the technology mecca. And I heard so much about how advanced everything was and how advanced the internet was. Then I get to the rural communities and find out, oh, there's no broadband. That's changing here. But that's still an issue for many other communities across the state.
Right. I live 3 miles outside of Springfield, just about 3 miles. And we only got high-speed internet in December of 2019. It was very fortuitous because it was right before the pandemic. But my neighbors who are 4 miles away up the road don't have it. And that's just outside of Springfield. So during the pandemic, we had kids and teachers that were sitting in parking lots at Starbucks that were using their mobile internet. Now, internet is a necessity. And I've been working with both senators and rural electric co-ops. If you think about broadband and the approach that the Biden administration is taking, they just put billions of dollars into providing broadband for rural communities. In Oregon, we got $689 million to put towards that project. But internet is now a necessity in the same way electricity was when rural electric co-ops came in after Roosevelt, right? Like after the Depression. And it changed people's lives. There's actually a great book written by the executive director of the Rural Electric Co-ops, Ted Case. It's called Power Plays. And it talks about the rural electric co-ops and presidential elections. It's fascinating. It's a short read. It's great. But really, how people's lives change to have, you know, an electric light, to have a washing machine, to have a dishwasher. Those things people didn't have. Now broadband is that important, and we need to make sure that every home has it. And again, I think the rural electric co-ops are really great partners to work with on making sure people have access.
It wasn't that long ago when everyone needed to have a horse in the barn.
Right.
Now everyone needs to have a car. And to see an 8-year-old with a cell phone in their hand, it's like, you know, mom and dad can stay in touch now, where, you know, we, as kids growing up, we never worried about that. So technology is changing to where most of it's becoming necessity.
Right. Yeah. My mother would just yell really, really loudly. Yeah. Very loudly.
I would disappear in the desert for hours at a time, and they wouldn't know where I was.
Right.
That was the bad thing. Yeah. Congresswoman Hoyle, thank you so much for stopping in today. I hope we covered some of the things that were on your mind, and you certainly have an open door here if you'd like to come back and discuss more.
I think the one thing I would say in leaving is that I want people to know that our office can help people navigate if they have issues with a federal agency, for instance, with passports. Because of the backlog from the pandemic, they're getting 500,000 passport applications a week. So it is taking 4 to 5 months to get a passport. It's taking 2 to 3 months, even if you pay for the expedited passport. If you haven't got your passport and you're within 2 weeks of needing to leave, contact our office. We can help with that. If people, have issues with their VA benefits, contact our office. We can help with that. Students interested in going into the military academy, contact our office. Or the IRS or federal payment plans having issues with that, contact our office, and we can help navigate with those federal agencies, and we'd be happy to do so. And thank you so much for the time, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, appreciate you coming by, and we'll do this again soon. Coming up next on the July edition of Our Town, a couple key members of the Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center hospice team.